Hello, thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to, of course, a podcast from CelticUnderground.net, a football fans podcast. Some people might say my life is in a rut. I'm quite happy with what I got. People might say that I should try for more, but I'm so happy I can't see the fine things happening here today. Finally, we live up to our promises, because last week's podcast extra with Brendan Rodgers and Neil Lennon after the Hibs game, I promised that I was recording a podcast on Wednesday night and we would get that out. Well, we're recording a podcast tonight, and St Anthony's also recorded a podcast tonight, so with definitely two podcasts coming up, this one and next one. So this is me with Sean Huddleston, who you'll remember him if you listened to the podcast 10 plus years ago, and well, we ramble a lot. So in the last wee while, we've been bringing back some guests who've been on the podcast a while ago. So this time it is the turn of Sean Huddleston. So for those people under the age of 30, they'll need a refresh. Sean, what have you been doing for the last 10 years since you were last on the podcast?
Well, I'm bringing myself up to date with different aspects of youth culture, Harry. I have been listening to a rappy artist called Lil Peep. I do believe he's very popular amongst the young people.
You certainly are in touch with kids more than I am.
And I've been learning the lingo as well. I've been patched by people. That is deliberately ignored, I do believe.
Oh, right. Yeah. I was actually going to ask for a...
In old money, you used to be dingied.
Right.
Yeah, so there we are. I'm helping people already, Harry, you know?
Well, last time you were on, you just finished a Celtic book. Oh, you can tell people where they can get it and pay the liquidators. Where's...
Yeah, well, don't buy, because I'm not getting any money.
tell them, actually, because we've just been talking off podcast.
Don't buy it. I'm going to publish it in Apple Books myself, all right?
tell people about the book. And why they shouldn't buy it.
Oh, God, yeah. You know, I can't even remember what it's called. it was The Lost Decade. It was Celtic in the 1980s.
Celtic in the 1980s, The Lost Decade. It's available in Kindle.
It's available on Kindle.
£1.19.
£1. It is actually down there at that amount. Yes, although it used to be a high flyer, you know, it used to be right up there, you know.
I believe it was a number one bestseller. You're being very modest.
It was at one point, yes. It was number one in Celtic books. And out of 12 reviews, I received at least 6 4 stars,
wow.
You know. Who can say that, Harry? You know,
I know this is covered in the last podcast. Why did you call it The Lost Decade?
Well, initially, looking back at the 1980s, God, you know, how many times do we look at, well, different junctures in Celtic's history and think, what a lost opportunity. What a lost opportunity to build on a strong position or build from strength. You know, it resonates with this summer, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To a certain degree. Although I still think we'll come good eventually anyway. I think we're coming good, actually, to rephrase that. But, you know, I think it was actually St. Anthony made the point, we still won 5 championships in the 1980s. The problem for us was we didn't move with the times quicker or quickly enough with our competitors. And by the end of that decade, all that success had been squandered to a large degree. You know, if you look at the start of the 1980s, we were narrowly losing to Real Madrid in the quarterfinals of the European Cup.
Mm-hmm.
By the 89-90 season, we were struggling to come third, weren't we? You know. So the contrast is actually very stark. So to that degree, I thought the title was actually quite apt, quite appropriate.
Do you know, with St. Andrew posting up regularly so many pictures from the 1980s in particular, I often think, and the problem of coming on here or even putting it online, again, something we talked about for the 45 minutes where we start the podcast,
about, which is far more interesting than what we're talking about now.
Yeah, Mr. Listener, we were talking about you.
I know the people are tweeting right now about it as well, yeah.
But one of the things you've got to be careful, because this is not a criticism of Billy McNeil or Davey Hay, who were managing the team through the 80s, because I think most football managers were like this. But I often look at pictures that St. Anthony stuck up of a team that included McGrain, Aitken, McLeod, Burns, Nicholas, McGarvey, Provin, later on McClare, Mo Johnson, Alan McInally and Mark McGee as backup strikers, Paul McStay. Yeah. I look at a team that through the 80s had the bulk of those players and think, imagine if we had a manager like a modern day football manager who did tactics instead of go out there and get about them. With those players, you can't help but think, considering you're talking about Real Madrid, we did manage to beat Real Madrid 2-0 at Celtic Park.
Yeah.
We did manage to beat Juventus 1-0 at Celtic Park and then only lose 2-0 away. We should have got past Rapid Vienna, who then went on to play Everton in the Cup Winners' Cup final. We drew 0-0 away to Notts Forest, who at the time were winning European Cups.
Yeah.
We were capable of getting an odd result. And then nowadays, when I then look back and think, if you'd had a tactical manager like Brendan or Strachan, that your lost decade comment of at the beginning of the decade we were competing with Real Madrid, you can't help but look at that decade and think, maybe if we'd also gone to Aberdeen and paid a couple of hundred grand for Alec McLeish or Willie Miller or both of them.
What a basis that could even, you know, Dundee United, you know, a Morris Malpass could have brought to the side in the mid-80s. You know, I mean, Dundee United got to the UEFA Cup final.
Well, I was just going to say, if you compare the managers in terms of, certainly, Billy McNeil, and I've read accounts from people like Murdo McLeod saying that when they were playing some of these top teams, they would approach the game knowing nothing about how the competition were going to play, because Big Billy would stand there and say, we're Celtic and we're going to play our way. And you look at Aberdeen and Dundee United, where certainly Ferguson, although in Scotland at the time he had the reputation for just barking and shouting at people, his time at Man United demonstrated he patently was a tactically astute manager, and Jim McLean was. They did get to European finals with teams that were competing with or better than.
Was there not a recent book published, the name escapes me, but Eamon Bannon was talking on it, or, you know, being interviewed on it, and he made the point that if they wore green and white hoops or royal blue jerseys, they would have won far more league championships than what they did. You know, that Dundee United side in the 1980s. And I thought that was a really telling comment, because, you know, again, there's two sides to that, where I don't know whether there was an inferiority complex or whatever the case may have been, but Ferguson and McLean were very, very diligent. They were very comprehensive in their planning. And everything they said, particularly to the media, it was never an accident, was it?
No.
You know? It was designed to galvanize. It was designed to antagonize even at times. But for somebody of Eamon Bannon's quality to turn around and make a comment like that, I find that very telling. There's different ways to take a comment like that. Is he talking about the club infrastructure? Is he talking about levels of ambition? Is he even talking about just mentality? You know, it actually raises more questions than answers, I suppose. And yeah, it comes back to, if we had an O'Neill or a Strachan or a Rogers at that time, would we have progressed more than we did at that time? Quite possibly. But, you know, some of the games you're pointing out there, again, it resonates with the modern era. That is the away European tie, isn't it? It is almost a runner's block, isn't it?
No. You know, yeah.
I would like to see statistics now from the 1980s to see how many European away ties we have actually succeeded in. We've actually got a result from.
There was last season when we were getting beaten by Zenit St. Petersburg away, and we'd had such a good performance at home that we should have scored more.
It was electrifying.
Yeah. And Chris Sutton kept saying, how can this team, who played so well last week at Celtic Park, be so abysmal tonight? And eventually, I was losing my patience, and eventually I tweeted saying, Chris, you can tell me.
Yeah.
You did it.
Did you have any first-hand experience, Chris?
Yeah. Instead of posing the question, should you not be proposing the answer? Because you've been there. Yeah. And of course, the brevity of the 140 characters of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And
is it not 280 these days?
Well, I'm an old school Twitter hand. Me.
So you're very self-disciplined, actually, you know.
and the some people being hard of thinking.
That's the Twitter equivalent of just passing it sideways, isn't it?
the element of some people being hard of thinking as well. People then start having a go at me saying, it's not Sutton's fault, he's not on the park. Don't have a go at Sutton about this. He took us to Seville. I wasn't having a go at Sutton. It was a genuine... Because, yes, Sutton took us to Seville. Actually, these people were making my point. Because the Sutton team that took us to Seville, mm-hmm. a few months later, played 10 men Anderlecht away from home and get beat. It wasn't a criticism of Sutton. It was the fact that, yes, we'd had Seville, but actually, we also, what was it, we went 22 Champions League away games before we won one.
Aye.
Something like that. Yeah, we were, you know...
We got our first away result, I think it was a 1-1 draw away to Barcelona, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was big Hartson score.
Hartson, that's right.
Yeah. Aye. I think that was O'Neill's last season as well, if I'm not mistaken.
We lost 2-0 under Martin O'Neill.
Speaking of Sutton, speaking of Neil Lennon, you know, people like us, they should be in a position to tell us this. You know, what has went wrong?
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of framing things like a modern phenomenon, this actually, you know, just even from a cursory glance there, I think this actually goes way further back than any of us possibly anticipated or realised. You know, we win against Juventus at home. We win against Real Madrid at home. We win against Rapid Vienna at home. And then we go away and the roof collapses, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. And it happens time and time and time again. Is the common denominator here the Celtic Park effect?
I think it's two things, because, look, under Brendan Rodgers, we drew with Man City away and at home. We got a better performance away to Borussia Mönchengladbach than we did at home.
And we should have won that game.
Yeah, we beat Anderlecht away and couldn't beat them at home.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all the exception.
Yeah.
Because the norm has been thumped to PSG, thumped to Barcelona, comfortably beaten by Salzburg.
AK Athens as well.
Yeah, it's. No matter the manager, no matter the players, no matter. There are teams that we beat, that we get beaten by, that if they were playing in Scottish football, wouldn't finish above us in the league.
No.
That's my issue. And you see our players doing stuff in terms of giving the ball away that they just don't do in domestic football.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be a mental thing. It must be.
Yeah. I think Scottish football sometimes, it, I don't want to say complacency, but it, it does breed a familiarity, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, players are funny beasts as well, you know. Players like their ruts, players like their routines, and they get used to them. And, you know, it doesn't help playing certain teams four times a year as well, does it? You know, in that sense.
I remember seeing Ree Wilkins on Sky talking about his time at Rangers and how it was brilliant, but two seasons at Rangers in term, was the equivalent of five seasons at an English Premiership team.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Because the better teams, you know, basically Celtic, you disproportionately played them in all the big games. And he said, so by the time I was two seasons at Rangers, I knew Paul McStay's inside leg measurement, and you just felt it was time to move on because it's been fantastic. But I know I'm talking about a Rangers player, but it's the principle of it.
Well, no, I think you need to look at anything for commonalities in that sense. I remember Terry Venables saying the only time he ever went to see Paul Gascoigne play was against Celtic, because the other fixtures were much of a muchness, and he never got a good grasp of how well he was playing, how confident he was, etc., etc., unless he was playing against, you know, as intense a fixture as that, you know? and Ray Wilkins' comment has been echoed by far, far lesser players than him. I think even Adam Rooney, when he moved to Salford, made a similar comment, if I'm not mistaken. I could stand corrected here, obviously. But I think he made a similar comment saying that he was looking forward to a new variety of, you know, different grounds to visit, different teams to visit, tactical challenges and so on, you know. I think, you know, sometimes the SPL, it can just be a slugging match, really, can't it, for a season, you know, to put too fine a point on it. And yet, when you do get to European football, all of a sudden, the intensity on so many different levels, whether it's tactical, whether it's psychological, even physical. The one thing I noticed about PSG, for example, are playing against Barcelona. I was watching Ronaldo the other night. I remember when they played, when Manchester United played, Nakamura scored the winner.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that always gets me about these teams is their physicality. They look really, really fit. They look strong and big, you know. And you never seem to get that with the SPL to a certain degree, you know. I remember Wayne Rooney getting on the ball and scaring the living daylights out of me with his pace, you know. And Wayne Rooney wasn't known for his pace, you know, but just get on the ball and his pace was just something I hadn't seen week in, week out with the SPL, you know. So I wonder, you know, is that gap, again, much bigger than we suspect as well? And even the best players, do they struggle with that jump up and that, what's the word I'm looking for, that relocation, you know, to a different level? I wonder, you know, well, is there a logic there, you know?
And I sometimes think, when I'm I don't know whether it's you know your memory plays tricks on you, but I also look at the performances in Europe away from home under a new manager, and when we buy a batch of new players, I always get the impression that we, instead of playing in European football, the idea should surely be the more we play in European football, gradually the better we get.
Yeah,
I sometimes think it's backwards. Because the more we play, the more we play in European football, the more our players then go drop into that Scottish game mindset of everybody. You know, it's that one of the phrases that really bugs.
The hangover coming back from those fixtures,
And one of the phrases that really bugs is, well, of course the Continentals are just better technically than us. Why, of course? Why, of course, are they technically better than us?
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that mindset then starts to kick in, that we're going overseas to play at a technically superior level of football. And eventually that seeps in, that negativity seeps into the players. And once they've been at Celtic for two or three seasons, they also go with that mindset. Whereas the new guy doesn't, because the new guy, well, you know, I've just come from Holland. Mm-hmm. And I played against these teams and they're nothing special.
Yeah. I have noticed more often than not that our performance every time we play a European tie, particularly away ties, is always very laboured. And like you're saying, my memory could be playing tricks on me. I could be, even, you know, my memory could be just fitting around the point I'm trying to make right now. But every single time I've watched a performance after a European tie, we look laboured. You know, we struggle to get through the game. And yeah, I wonder, you know, again, do we find that shift too difficult at times? Yeah, you know, it's almost counterintuitive, isn't it? Is that we, like you're saying, the more European football we should be playing, the better we should be getting.
Yeah.
Whereas it's almost the reverse. We find the struggle to deal with that switch in levels too intense, and we just struggle to deal with the whole shebang now, don't we, you know?
And I do sometimes wonder,
regardless of who's the manager.
Yeah, and I sometimes wonder when we come back to domestic football, European football, that actually, because we played at such a high level, there is such a complacency coming back of, well, we're playing at a shit level compared to what we were doing midweek.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, do the players like think themselves, I was playing at the Parc des Princes on Wednesday night, and now I'm playing at McDermott Park.
The only thing I would say, that I remember Neil Lennon, and I think I've said this in the podcast before, I remember Neil Lennon talking about how you're on such an emotional high after a big game that you don't sleep. You hardly sleep the next day. So if you think about, we're going to play, we're recording this Wednesday, so we're going to play tomorrow night, Thursday.
All right.
And the players will then not really, from what Lennon was saying, the players will not really sleep Thursday night, partly because they'll be travelling back, and then they'll go in maybe just to, I don't know, what they're probably just going for a warm down on Friday, but without having really had much sleep Thursday. And then obviously they'll go to sleep Friday night, Saturday being the only training day that we've got prior to the game on Sunday.
Well, in this sense, I think this week, the Hearts game is actually a good thing, because they will need to keep up that intensity level. But I remember, like, coming back from the Barcelona game, and I didn't sleep a wink that night, because I was just completely delirious. Now, you know, imagine you were Tony Watt.
Yeah.
Or Joe Ledley or Scott Brown that night. Jesus, would you be able to sleep a wink that night?
No.
You know, you'd be so happy, and it'd be understandably, you know, wonderfully so. Everybody's just human, Harry, at the end of the day, you know? And then, like you're saying, add in actual practical difficulties, like travelling back from a foreign destination. Even a place like Paris, I think Paris is an hour ahead.
Yeah.
Even, you know, even a minimal time difference like that will still mess with you, you know? And you don't know whether you're coming or going, I suppose, to a certain degree. And yeah, like you say, you can try and mitigate to a certain degree. You know, you maybe have bunk beds at the training ground or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. But it'll still have an effect, won't it?
Yeah. You know? But the original point of this from your 80s book.
I had a point.
About, we just have never been very good away from home in Europe.
Yeah. And I think this is the common thread now, isn't it? It could almost be the subject of a new book, couldn't it?
Do you know? So there,
that really rubbish away ties in Europe by Sean Hubble.
Yeah. So two things. One, you need to explain to people why you make no money out of that book, and two, why haven't you written the decades, the 90s, a decade of two halves? Why have you not done that?
Okay. Well, it turned out...
Since you promised Eddie in the last podcast that your next book was going to be about the 90s.
I promise lots of things, Harry. as one dad to another, you know, we promise our children lots of things every day, you know, and we don't carry it half of it.
You can play the Xbox. I promise you, I'll play with the Xbox with you tonight.
Dad, can you get off the Wii? No, I'm having another game. I've got to beat my record here. Although I did, my wee boy, my eldest, he's getting right into football. And Moussa Dembele was his favourite player.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I'd have a few years grace before, you know, your wee man asks you, you know, what's happened with Moussa Dembele, Dad? Where's he gone? You know, I thought I'd have a few years grace before having to have that chat about your kid's favourite player leaving, you know? I remember asking my dad about Frank McAvaney leaving, you know?
Can you come on here? I'll bring St. Anthony on. You can have a chat with him about Kenny Dalglish leaving. Nobody ever had that chat with him.
Oh, God, yeah. I think he'd probably end up breaking down, wouldn't he?
He's written a Celtic book since you did yours.
But at that time, I remember, I was 10 in the centenary year. And I think, you know, you reach the age where everything starts to click. You understand what a league is. You understand, you know, at a very, very basic level, obviously, tactics. And you understand how, you know, he's a good one. He's not so good.
Yeah.
He's all right. But even I knew whenever Frankie signed, I think we've got a really good player here, you know. And whenever he left, I couldn't comprehend it. Why would he leave? You know, this is Celtic. Does he not want to play for Celtic? Does he not support Celtic? I wouldn't leave Celtic. Well, what's the matter with him? And it's only when you get a bit older, you realise that London has various attractions that Glasgow doesn't. And that's a podcast topic on itself now, isn't it?
No, there are still a number of Celtic fans who don't quite get the concept of earning a lot of money in London or in a different country that's warmer has appeals over wet rainy Glasgow on a 10% of what you could earn somewhere else.
Even in the '80s, you know, when London was distinctly less glamorous.
Yeah.
You know. I had to explain to my wee boy that Moussa Dembele had left Celtic, you know, and he goes, "Why?" And he says, "Well, he's joined another team." He goes, "But why would he do that, Dad?" And I remember I just went, "There's Tom Rogic." Let's watch the Tom Rogic clip on YouTube, son. Let's do that. You know, squirrel. Yeah. Oh, do you want some Haribo? Haribo, that's, you know, don't worry about your dinner, son. That's not a problem, you know. So I thought I'd have a few years grace on that, yeah. So, where were we? Yes, what has happened to my book? Well, it was only ever an e-book, because they wanted to publish it electronically first and then do a publish on demand system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it turned out a year later, my publisher went bust.
Sevco Publishing went out of business.
God damn it. My plans for world domination are currently on hold, you know. What happened to the next one? The original plan was for the 80s to be followed by a book about the 90s. And I found myself getting more and more depressed the more I wrote and researched about the 90s. just waking up in a cold sweat of, you know, De Canio hitting the bar in that Celtic Rangers game.
Yeah.
You know? Andy Double, I keep on having flashbacks. You know, where did he come from, for Christ's sake, you know? And he played the game of his life that day. But it was supposed to be a sort of stopgap in between my master's and whenever I would eventually start a PhD. And sure enough, a couple of years after I published that book, I started my PhD research. And this is my last year. 6 years part-time. And next September is when I'm supposed to submit. So, that, you know, it is true what they say. PhDs do take up a lot of your time. And it's a bit Yoda. Is, you know, Yoda-esque. With a PhD, you do it or you don't do it. You know, there's no in between.
There is no try, only do.
You don't dip your toe in and out every so often. You are doing it whether you like it or not, or you're not doing it. It's as simple as that. Would I like to go back and finish off things? Of course I would. Because again in my head I thought, right, 80s, then do the 90s, and then do the 2000s. And I think myself and Eddie had this, good old man's around about the term the noughties.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he, what do you call it? Well, not the noughties anyway, for Christ's sake, you know.
I just avoid calling it anything because I just can't stand the phrase the noughties. I don't know why.
It's very, I don't want to annoy people here, you know. It always struck me as very New Labour for some reason.
You know, I was just going to say the same. It's very North London New Labour.
Yeah, you know, Cool Britannia and stuff like that, yeah. Again, it could just be a word association or whatever, but
you can just imagine lots of people on Five Live loving using it, things like that.
Well, I'm being unfollowed on Twitter as I speak right now, yeah. SMP bad, SMP bad, yeah. although I won't mention his name, but I was talking to a certain person on Twitter, and we were castigating government policy on a certain section, shall we say, which will remain nameless.
Well, I'll just to help you out there, a friend of mine who works in education, I will message him an education story and he'll just say, have I told you the SNP have fucked up education? And this is someone who's not, anyway, he knows who he is.
We were slagging off current educational policy, and this Zoomer weighs in and goes, you know, who the hell do you guys think you are, you know? And I said, well, I've only been teaching 16 years. I like to think I've got a bit of skin in the game. And he goes, well, you're either a unionist or a journalist or both. God.
Do you know, getting back to a pre-podcast 45-minute chat, it is one of the problems of social media that if you make a comment that's critical, you have to have an agenda to that comment. You can't just be making a critical comment. So if you make a criticism of the education system has been buggered up by the SNP, you are a unionist who hates the SNP. Mm-hmm. No, I just think that they've made a mess of the education system.
Yes.
I could say the Tories have made a mess of this, Labour have made a mess of that, and the Lib Dems have made a mess of being anonymous.
Yeah. We discussed this before the podcast went on air. All right, there is zero nuance or level of discussion on social media nowadays, regardless of what platform you're on, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whatever the kids are on these days, you know, your snappy chat or whatever. And like you're saying, there's two aspects to the problem you're talking about. First of all, people on social media now don't want to hear something contrary to their own opinion and prejudices. The other thing as well, and it's also been scientifically proven, is that if you get a like or a retweet or, you know, a shared option on Facebook or Twitter, whatever the case may be, the chemical reaction is the same as a gambler getting a hit, you know, in a card game or something like that, you know? the chemical reaction is the same, and the more retweets, the more you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you've got two distinct aspects there, and it's not that both of them are not healthy. And as we're discussing before as well, it's now reached a stage now where if you were in possession of important, and I use that term in inverted commas, important information about, say, educational policy, or even about your favorite football team,
mm-hmm.
you would think several times before tweeting that or putting that on Facebook or whatever the case may be, because the reaction to that news would be so lacking in nuance and lacking in any sort of level of reasonable discussion. Is it really worth your time, you know, doing that for the reaction you would get? No, of course not, you know? So I think in some aspects, social media is really good because it allows you to connect with people you wouldn't have had the opportunity to connect with before.
Yep.
And it's actually even been better meeting people in the flesh who you've made contact with on social media. But you have to be very careful not to allow social media just become a reinforcement platform. I deliberately follow some accounts with the sheer notion, or, you know, with the sheer idea that I know this person is going to tweet stuff that is going to annoy me, that's mm-hmm. going to make me happy, that I'm not going to agree with. Because it's going to be, counterintuitively, it's going to be healthier for me. I don't like what some people tweet, but it actually challenges you to have a better basis for your own opinions.
Yeah, well, even if you are following somebody who has a political position that's not the same as yours, mm-hmm. and they then are retweeting, you know, so their timeline of on Twitter is going to be full of articles that you never come across. So even mm-hmm. if you just follow one person who's politically different to you, and they will then retweet articles that you wouldn't normally come across.
Yeah.
And even if those articles, a majority of it, just nonsense or whatever,
mm-hmm.
there will be elements of truth within them that if you are reasonably intelligent and are open, as you've just talked about wanting to at least have an understanding of the opposition, of the other side of the argument.
Yeah.
There will be stuff that you will start to think, there is a bit of truth in what he's saying there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, this is the way the world used to be. Then, should they move you away from being unquestionably adhering to the views that of the people that you agree with? Because you're then going to start to think, yeah, but that's not 100%. Because, you know, one of my favourite phrases in life, there's three sides to every story.
Yeah.
There's your side, there's my side, and the truth somewhere in the middle. And the truth might be 90% of my side or 90% of your side. But the element is, nobody's got a monopoly on the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, in politics, I've met quite a lot of politicians from different parties. And actually, a lot of them got into politics to make people's lives better. It's just mm-hmm. they think that their way of making people's lives better is different to the way that the other guy thinks.
Mm.
They're not always wrong, evil, nasty people.
No.
They just think they can arrive at the same outcome of everybody being better off a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I might think it's the wrong way, but it doesn't mean that they're wrong. And it just means that they're not. I don't think they're right. There's a difference.
Yeah, I think the problem there as well, Harry, is, again, we discussed this before we went on air, is that, you know, for right or for wrong, the mainstream media nowadays And I use that term very, very loosely, and I'm actually quite reticent to use that term. That's called the established media.
Yeah. You know,
there is a credibility vacuum, whether anybody likes it or not, from lots of different sides and from lots of different sections. They will simply not countenance giving credibility to stories or articles from certain newspapers or certain news channels, regardless.
Mm-hmm.
So that vacuum is being filled by different social media prominent individuals or bloggers or what, you know, again, whatever the case may be. And that is not allowing people to be exposed to attitudes, articles, positions that would actually force them to have a better basis for their own opinions, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is why I try my best to avoid any sort of real debate on social media, because the net outcome is that you will always lose out. You will not help people realize, you know, to establish a better basis with their own position, nor will you persuade people that their position is wrong. And you also become quite defensive yourself. You know, it's not healthy for your own sake. I remember it was actually yourself, Harry. I went to the Celtic Hamilton game,
mm-hmm.
and Boyata touched the ball. And I was sitting in the main stand and I started booing, and I noticed everybody around me not booing. In fact, everybody started clapping. I went, oh, bollocks. And then I looked on Twitter and there was a tweet from yourself that that obviously criticized people that were in my way, you know. And again, that encapsulated, you know, the reason I booed him that day, Harry, was I was just so angry with him. And I couldn't think of any other constructive or non-constructive way to show how unhappy I was with him, you know. And then the replies that were coming back to yourself showed, again, just the complete lack of nuance, the complete lack of depth to that argument. I knew that by booing him, I wasn't helping him, Harry, you know, and I wasn't helping the team. But I was, you know, I just had complete tunnel vision. And your point was correct as well, you know. And like you're saying, the truth is somewhere in between there, isn't it?
Yeah. So, nobody's got a monopoly on the truth.
No. Well, this is where I also get very, you know, as a part-time academic, I get very defensive about research ethics. Recently there's been an initiative to try and, what's the word I'm looking for? Fight back against anti-Irish prejudice in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, as somebody who suffered that, I've got no problem with that initiative, you know, more power to it. But what we need in that respect is more evidence, more recorded evidence, and more empirical data. Because with any position, you need to demonstrate evidence to back up your position. Otherwise, it's just an opinion, isn't it?
Do you know, one of my... I actually love...
Yeah. We need, you know, if you're serious about challenging this type of prejudice, we need to record as much stuff as possible. We need to have more empirical data as possible in order to demonstrate how serious a problem this is, how deep a problem this is, and also to maybe even illustrate possible ways forward as well, you know. But anyway,
I love sometimes statistics that seem counterintuitive. Because people just go through their lives, and we all do it, forming your opinion based on anecdotal evidence. So this is part, maybe it's the awkward part in me, that sometimes when I come across really good empirical evidence that justifies a position which is not, and I'm not saying this in relation to Irish anti-Irish bigotry, I'm saying about your point of there's nothing more important than well-researched evidence to back up a point or back up information or a position, because I love getting that information, partly because knowledge is king, and then, you know, if you're getting into an argument with someone, there's nothing better to them be able to shoot down their position by just knowing all the facts. Because eventually they then get into the position of having to take a Nigel Farage or Michael Gove position of, well, I've just had enough of statistics and the experts. There's no rationale behind their counter-argument.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Harry. There is no substitute for evidence. There's no substitute for results in that, in a whole scope of different things like that. But if you're going to be serious about any sort of topic, regardless of whether it's prejudice or even football, you know, the amount of statistics you have will always aid and improve your argument, you know. Even thinking back to, I remember reading about Arsene Wenger taking off Dennis Bergkamp on the 70th minute, wasn't it?
He used
to take him off in the 70th minute. And Dennis Bergkamp challenged him. He said, why you take me off? He says, look at the results. you start flagging in 70 minutes. You know, there is no debate. It's happening. Deal with it, you know? And because it was there in black and white, because it was indisputable, he had no argument, you know? Coming back to my original point, there is very little empirical data with regards to this type of prejudice as well. So the more research that takes place about this sort of thing, the better we'll be in the long run as well. So, I would happily carry out that research for $5,000.
I'll do it for $400-$500. But actually, there's a part of me thinks Scottish civil society doesn't want that research done.
No,
because whilst the problem exists, certainly anecdotally, you'll know better than me being Irish, but certainly from the Catholic aspect of it, the level of bigotry in Scotland is very different now to where it was 40 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Very, very, you know, it's just not acceptable for, you know, for high profile employers like the Clydesdale Bank, the Herald, and football clubs to just have an unspoken, but everybody knows it exists, non-employment of Catholic rule. That type of thing has gone. And you just get the impression that the sort of chattering classes of Scotland think that it's now just a dirty down market football thing, and maybe happens in some of the more down market parts of Glasgow and Lanarkshire and Ayrshire. But it's down market people that do it, and we can just ignore it because it doesn't exist.
There was research done, and it was about opinions on the origins and main areas with regards to sectarian behaviour. And lo and behold, it was just a complete reinforcement of people's opinions. People from outside Glasgow believed there was a Glasgow problem. People from the greater Glasgow area believed it was a Scottish-wide problem. And I think that the top two avenues for sectarian behaviour in people's opinions were loyal order marches and football matches.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the statistics for arrests with regards to sectarian behaviour are in public places on a Friday and Saturday night, usually between 10 and 2 a.m., you know, 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., you know. So, again, the opinions don't marry up with the evidence.
And this is actually one of the things that frustrates me about football, that it doesn't do the economic research, as I've banged on about enough times in this podcast about its economic value, but also doesn't do that research. And, you know, as people know, I have met with Peter Lawwell on a couple of occasions, and one of the things I have... Yeah. Did you not hear that big clang?
You should have advertised that.
Although nowhere near as much.
Did you meet him with another well-known Celtic supporter? You really need to get this sort of thing out here.
No, nowhere near as much as some people seem to think, and certainly by the men Celtic seem to say that I am. There's certainly people on their podcast meeting more regularly than I do. My point is, if you do, getting back to it, if you do the research on that, and you do the research on the economic value, and you do the research on the bigotry side of things, then the minute that I toss a Les Gray from the ex-Police Federation guy comes on the radio and uses football as the bogeyman to minimise police cuts in Scotland, because that's my perception of all he's ever doing. Whenever there's, you know, we're in an austerity period of 10 years now, let's try and ring fence, the best way to ring fence the police from cuts is to create a bogeyman, and the easy bogeyman is big bad football.
Yeah.
The greatest way to combat that is to turn around and say, that's a lie, that's a false statement, because, I mean... He was on Radio Scotland talking about there was an issue to do, I can't remember what game it was, it was a Celtic Rangers game and about something. And Kenny McIntyre asked him the leading question of just how many millions does policing of these games cost society?
Yeah.
Loads. Pure Hunters, by the way, big man. I mean, it wasn't quite, but it's pretty much that.
It's this big. It's this big. I'm holding my hands out, and it's really wide, the gap between my hands.
It's huge. Yeah, you know? And you just love someone to turn around and say, no, football generates £190 million a year in Glasgow, and we pay X millions of pounds in taxes, and football policing cost is Y millions of pounds, so actually we're a net contributor.
Also add in associated internal factors with football fans self-police on a far greater level than if you were to go to the Barras or even the SECC, and you go to music concerts or you go to Tea in the Park. You are statistically more at danger at these places than you are at a football game. That is an evidential fact, you know? But again, that does not marry up with the narrative. That does not marry up with what the chattering classes and various commentators would like you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And again, look at the benefits that football clubs, not just in this city, but around Scotland, bring in terms of tourism, in terms of even diversity, in terms of the economy, in terms of, you know, people going for a bite to eat and different other things like that, hotels, etc., etc. Why aren't we promoting this better? Why aren't we being proactive? There's an academic, Jeff Pearson, did an ethnographic study of England fans at different World Cups. And one of the biggest contrasts he noted was at the Germany World Cup. He said the German police were much, much proactive and very much more engaged with the England support, to the extent where the amount of trouble that could have been caused was very, very minimal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they're willing to engage with them. It was willing that they were actually willing to get to know them.
Yep.
You know, they were directing them to the best pubs to go to, the best clubs, the best restaurants, what areas the cities to stay out of, whether or not to stay in big groups or wee groups, that sort of stuff. You know, and even they were having a laugh with them. Like I said, they were getting to know them. You don't get that impression from how football fans in Scotland are treated. They are treated as if they are a a slumbering element of trouble just waiting to erupt. And this is where you had the criminalization bill emanating from. It was purely as a stopgap and a bogeyman tactic to deal with a very serious and historically significant problem. That completely the wrong section, if you want to put it like that.
And this then gets back to your comment earlier about where the bigotry occurs in Scottish society most commonly, and my issue with the Offensive Behaviour of Football Act. If we, it's a combination of things, and I raised this with, you know, when we did the podcast with the MSP about Scotland's never really had a sectarian problem. Scotland has had an anti-Irish, anti-Catholic problem. But for me, calling it sectarian, this is the things that frustrate me about it. Calling it sectarian then makes it seem like they're two cheeks of the same arse problem.
So
that's part of it. And we know that it's only dirty down market football that's the problem. And it's sectarian, which is an equal thing. So that's part of my issue with it, instead of calling it what the problem is. Then if we do have that sectarian and offensive, by making it sectarian and offensive, it then, to assist that, say, two cheeks of the same arse thing, it was then, there was all this false equivalence of something that was a lesser, if you're going to start grading, if you're going to then start calling stuff offensive, something that was a lesser offensive remark was then put into the same bag as something that was a much more offensive remark. To give that balance to it. And then the final thing was, if we genuinely have a problem with sectarianism and offensive stuff, why ring fence it around football? If we want to weed this out of Scottish society, we want to weed it out of Scottish society, so don't make it at football. Make it anywhere, anytime, you know, make it a martini bill, anytime, any place, anywhere.
Criminalise everything. That was the biggest issue I had with the criminalisation bill was that it was all in the eye of the beholder.
And
I remember there was one particular case where the police officer who arrested the football fan was offended personally at what the football fan had said or sung. And I remember thinking, what has that got to do with it? What law has this person broke? You know, if they're being offensive, that is very different to actually being law-breaking. You know, has this person broken a window? Have they beaten somebody up? You know, have they mugged somebody? Before the Offensive Behaviour Act, if you mug somebody or beat somebody up or, you know, attacked a shopkeeper or something like that, and you use sectarian language, you could have the prefix religiously aggravated assault. Or whatever the case may be. Now, it was assuming that, A, whoever was doing the accusation was indefatigable or, you know, Their word was gospel to a large degree, which is why so many trials went so far in court as well, from what I could see. But also, it wasn't actually contextualizing or, you know, actually looking in any deep level what this person had actually done. Had they broken any actual laws apart from, again, you know, in inverted commas, being offensive? And you know, that's no way to deal with any sort of prejudice.
No, I mean, there was a guy...
Simply not.
There was a guy arrested coming out of a Celtic St Johnson game. A Celtic fan arrested. And I think he'd obviously had a few jars as well. And I think Celtic were either level or losing, or they weren't winning the game. And he'd left. He'd left early and had shouted at the stadium something about Celtic being a bunch of shy Fenian bastards or something like that. And was arrested. And I remember thinking, he's howling at the wind, right? He's shouting at a noisy football crowd who have all got their backs to him, so nobody in that stadium can hear him.
Yes.
Plus, who was offended? Getting back to your point,
the law actually stipulated that you didn't have to actually directly offend anybody, but you could have possibly offended somebody.
So
it was ludicrous.
What went through my mind at that time was, so what was the difference between him shouting that out loud to nobody, and if what really was the difference between that and him thinking it loudly in his head?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Because nobody was hearing it, bar the police officers who were following him out of the ground because he'd left early and there was a bit...
Recontextualise that, Harry, as well. If he had been in a taxi queue in the middle of Glasgow on a Saturday night, he wouldn't be arrested for that.
No.
You know? And just allied to that, again, I was made aware of an account. A Partick Thistle fan was arrested for shouting F the Pope and F the Queen. You know? And not just the fact that he was arrested for shouting that, which is ludicrous in itself, but I think there was a dawn raid on his house. You know, that sort of stuff. A complete waste of resources. There was a, you know, police wagon outside his house. He was told that he was being arrested for, you know, the Offensive Behaviour Act. He was pointing at his mum's living room that he was in. You know, a portrait of the Pope and Holy Lady and whatnot. And explain, how can I be anti-Catholic? You know, look at my wall here. You know, look at my mum's wall. And it was just a complete ludicrous situation. And it brings me back to my original point is, are you really dealing with prejudice? You know, enacting a law in that way? Or you're not getting to the vein of things. You're not getting to the deep-rooted causes of things there, are you?
It's almost like the laws, getting back to your creating statistics and empirical evidence. So, see, if you wanted to create a law to create a set of statistics,
mm-hmm.
to then allow you to point the finger of blame at the place that you want to get the blame, because at the moment the statistics don't say that the place that you want to get the blame is, mm-hmm. is the problem, you would create the Offensive Behaviour of Football Act.
Well, even then, it blew up in their face as well. I think out of the top 10 matches that saw the most arrests under that bill, the top three weren't Celtic Rangers games. I think one of them was actually Scotland against England.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. and again, for every statistically, for every Celtic or Rangers fan arrested under this bill, there was somebody else arrested from another team. Which again put forward the notion that this is not inverted commas Old Firm problem. It is a nationwide problem, whether you like it or not. So yeah, the statistics were completely flawed in that sense. I might actually defeat my own argument here. yeah, quite possibly. But you know, I'll just ignore that and just shout fake news and what have you. Yeah, shut up. I'll just say shut up to everybody else.
Well, that's far too polite.
This
you've got to say F off to everybody.
Construction of bad laws as well, doesn't it? You know,
exactly.
And again, come the revolution, that we will change this and the world will be merry.
because we do have a monopoly on being right.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Otherwise, I'm snookered, aren't I? Although, you know, dealing with a 6 and 4 year old every day, I know my place. I am not right in any shape or form whatsoever.
Exactly. But having gone on that very long ramble around stuff, you have an event coming up.
Do I? Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. Yeah, I was happily forgetting about
now
that.
Now that you've not written the books, and we've moved on from the no 90s and the no whatever the next decade's called book.
Definitely not called the noughties.
Yeah. Celtic, not in the noughties. tell us about your event.
Yes. Well, I'm very proud to be part of a group called the Football Collective. which is primarily an academic group, but not exclusively an academic group. And it is designed to further improve and facilitate critical debate within the game. And we have had two annual conferences up until now, and the next one, lo and behold, is going to be in Glasgow in November, at the end of November. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be at Hampden Park. And at the minute, we have over 130 people attending. We have over 70 presenters, and we have three keynote panels. And it is the keynote panels that I'm probably most, not just excited about, but very proud about, Harry, to be perfectly honest. Because not only do we have, you know, really good academics presenting at these panels, for example, we've got a panel on gender and football. Mm-hmm. And that has been facilitated and chaired by Alex Colvin, who herself is not just a PhD student, but she's a football player herself. She's actively involved in the game, and she is she's chairing that panel. We've got another panel on race and football. This is where I sound most Belfast-y as well, because I can't roll my R's, and this is where I do a disservice to Pira's name, but Pira Power from the Fair Network is going to be on that panel, but also Paul Elliott, former Celtic, Aston Villa and Chelsea and England internationalist, is going to be on the panel as well. And we've also got a politics and football panel, and that's got Glasgow University's own Maureen McBride, who's done extensive research into the effects of politics on football, for example, but also people like John Kelly from University of Edinburgh, and Danny Fitzpatrick, who's done, again, very notable research into that relationship between politics and football. I'm very proud with my own contribution to this and facilitation list. This is the sort of event that I think not just Scottish football, but Scotland generally needs is just bringing in that level of critical debate. And again, challenging positions, challenging viewpoints, challenging attitudes, but also showcasing the best research and the best evidence that's out there about different issues and aspects about society through the prism of football, it has to be said. I'm really looking forward to it, and hopefully a few listeners have got tickets to it as well. So,
are there any tickets left?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me about that. Because initially, whenever I contacted you, we were really struggling, and it was a bit like that Father Dougal line from Father Ted. You know, you told me, you didn't tell me I had to follow up one good idea with another good idea. I want out. It's too much. Initially when I contacted you, we were really struggling, and now, quite frankly, we're not. There's about five tickets left. jump in quick, folks, and you won't regret it.
You do have a webpage.
We do, and now that is the other thing, though, that if you cannot physically make it, presentations will be live tweeted, and it is hoped that all the keynote panels will be streamed live as well. For example, the last conference I organised, the first and the only conference dedicated to football and prejudice in Scotland, we live streamed all the keynote speeches, and we had we were trending in Glasgow on social media, but there were people as far away as Russia and America were, watching the keynote presentations as they were happening, and we're looking forward to that level of engagement and connection this time around as well. So if you can't make it, then keep an eye out for it, because I'm fairly certain what you will witness and what you will see will be of note and of interest.
See, I love Glasgow as a city. I mean, nothing's perfect, and obviously it's got faults and it's got issues.
And
anything in life could be better. But I love Glasgow, and I love football.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a football conference in Glasgow, and I'm actually on your website just now, and you have managed to get beautiful pictures connected with football. And I mean, just generally football, you know, challenging the narrative, critical thinking in football at Glasgow. It frustrates the hell out of me that football creates all this money for Glasgow, and if you go to the Glasgow tourist buses, you will not visit the home of football, Hampden. You will not visit two of the biggest, most passionately supported football club, the grounds of two of the most passionately supported football clubs in Europe, in Celtic and Rangers.
Yeah.
You will not go to the eerie, mystical Third Lanark ground at Cathkin Park. You'll not go to, I always think of Partick Thistle, they're a bit like the Lib Dems, as a part of me thinks, surely you could be doing better of finding a space between these two rival groups.
Partick Thistle, they go on another rant in this podcast. Partick Thistle frustrates the hell out of me, man, you know. They should be bigger and better than what they are, you know.
They would argue
there's room for them.
They would argue they're squeezed out by it.
Absolutely nonsense.
But the reason why I use the politics thing of the more that the Tories are a disaster and moving to the right, and Labour are not managed very well, carefully, because the people who love Corbyn can't see beyond them. But you've got the most catastrophic Conservative government in my lifetime,
yes,
and Labour are 5% behind them in the polls. Uh-huh. So, to use your empirical evidence thing, patently they're not doing well if they're not 20 points ahead of the Tory party. As Corbyn's moved Labour to the left, Tories moving to the right. I look at British politics as somebody who sees myself a bit apolitical and think, bloody hell, surely the Lib Dems should be forging ahead and as being we're the opposite of those two, right? Yeah. I don't know, politics nuts would then be shouting at me. I think the same way at Partick Thistle, and in politics a Lib Dem would say, oh, that's because we're squeezed out by the big two. No, you've got a fantastic opportunity of saying, we're just the opposite of them. Same with Thistle. If they think they're squeezed out, and they would argue because, getting back to your earlier debate, that because of the bigotry of Celtic Rangers and blah, 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 well, surely there's a perfect niche for you. One, how many hundreds of thousands of students come to Glasgow every year, maybe don't, who you, and particularly a position in the West End, to be that different offering of not Celtic Rangers? And then how many Glaswegians? I agree with you. Thistle, I just think you could create something better out of yourselves.
Yeah. They are in, socioeconomically speaking, they are in the best area of Glasgow, if you want to put it like that, or at least they're next door to it.
Yeah.
You know? I've been to a couple of Thistle games, before, and again, just a snapshot of my experiences there. You know, you're not talking about a support that is struggling to attract folk from the higher, sections of society in terms of socioeconomic positions, if that makes sense. They've got a ground in a really good location. They've actually got room to expand. What is the matter with this picture? I just don't understand. I think it actually goes to, for a lot of, I get frustrated with Scottish football in generally in terms of there are a lot other teams out with Celtic and Rangers who go, you know, oh, but we are so small, we cannot compete, you know.
Yeah.
And that is our life. I am a Partick Thistle fan, therefore I bleed, you know.
Do you know, I remember...
And that is life. And that is the tragedy. And you go, well, yeah, really? Yeah.
I remember a couple of seasons ago when St Johnstone and Aberdeen had been knocked out of Europe by teams from countries ranked like 40 places below Scotland. And really teams... And I just tweeted something about... Celtic or Rangers get knocked out of Europe, we get a hard time from the press.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And St Johnstone and Aberdeen, and teams of St Johnstone and Aberdeen's level get away with it because their fans have accepted mediocrity.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Jim Spence picked it up. I did it 2 years in a row, roughly saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. Both times Jim Spence picked it up and said, do you agree? And all these people then came back at me, supporters of St Johnstone and Aberdeen, those types of teams, came back at me making points that sort of reinforced my point of they'd accepted mediocrity. Or we can't accept. How do you expect us to do any better? Because you're playing a team from Lithuania whose average attendance is 1,500.
Yeah. I mean, was it Hibs got beat 7-1 by Malmo?
Yeah.
That time. I think I tweeted something quite similar to yourself, but in far less diplomatic language. I think I said something to the effect of, do some Scottish teams have the balls to succeed, basically, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the gumption to, you know, show a level of ambition? Or, you know, do they walk out on the pitch in fixtures like this already beaten? I think for quite some time there, that was the case, you know? Thankfully, it seemed to be rectified to a certain degree this season. I think Hibs were actually quite unlucky in their fixtures that they played this season, truth be told. But Aberdeen, for the last few seasons, have they really had that excuse? I'm not too sure if they have. You know,
Aberdeen on the Thistle, in the same, they're in the same boat as Thistle,
mm-hmm.
that they accept that a good crowd is 13,000. The town of Aberdeen's a one-team town with a population of 250,000. And Aberdeenshire has another population of 250,000 with only Peterhead in it. And that's 500,000 people.
Yes.
But they don't mark... For me, there is, I mean, it's a bit of a catch-22 because they're continually... They speculate to accumulate Murray years, encourage the... made the press, encourage clubs that they've got to spend money, and we've spent the last 20 years... recalibrating the finances of Scottish football on the back of the financial disaster that was created by him. But they don't market their... They get the number of people who will turn up because they're Aberdeen.
Mm-hmm.
They should, if they got the same percentage attendances as happens in the rest of Scottish football, they should have an average attendance of 25,000.
Yes, They literally have no competition.
Yeah,
up in that area of the country.
They should have this weekend's cup finals.
If and when they move to their new ground, that might change. You know, will we see a change in mindset? Quite possibly.
I don't know.
I'm hoping. You know, I'm being more optimistic here. but yeah, there are so many teams, so many clubs who, like you say, are quite happy to just wrestle back on, you know, oh, we give it our best shot, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of attitude. It's simply not good enough in this day and age, you know, especially when they're charging fans the highest prices, you know.
Aberdeen's insistence.
At Hearts and Hibs and Aberdeen are paying quite high prices to watch their team. Surely they should expect something better.
Aberdeen's insistence on a 50-50 split for the Cup semi against Rangers.
Don't even start being that, sorry.
Aberdeen have never, even in the peak of Alex Ferguson's years, Aberdeen have never had more than about 10,000, 11,000 people turn up at a Cup semi-final. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand they're travelling a long way from Glasgow, and it's a cup semi, not the final. So, but they've never, their average attendance is 12,000-13,000.
In their
captive audience city, and they've never had it. So why they ask for half of Hampden for a semi final when they've never sold out?
This is actually, I would broaden this out. I think this is actually a common tactic now amongst any team playing Celtic or Rangers at Hampden. They will demand, again in inverted commas, a 50-50 split, or as close to a 50-50 split, because they don't want to see Hampden full of opposition fans, for starters. They want to hamstring who they're playing against. And they realise they've got a better chance of playing against, you know, a crowd of 40,000 with maybe 15,000 of their own fans, you know, comprising that, than they would of 50,000 with, you know, four-fifths being Celtic or Rangers fans.
Yep.
Hibs did it in a League Cup semi, I think it was last season, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They demanded close to that. Motherwell did the same in the Scottish Cup final. They were never going to sell that many tickets. Never. You know? My rule of thumb actually is, whatever the capacity of your ground is, you get that many tickets, if that makes sense. You know, so for Aberdeen, I think the capacity of Pataudry is what, 21,000?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. You know, you are filling Pataudry, if you want to put it like that. And unless you can prove otherwise, that's the amount you're getting, basically. And it was the same with Hibs and Motherwell. I did understand, but from a very cynical perspective, why they would demand a 50-50 split.
And then the problem also,
it's going to be very interesting as well. Murrayfield, this is going to be a whole new equation now, isn't it?
Murrayfield is
more or less a 50-50 split, isn't it?
Yeah. I think we both pretty much close to sold out.
Mm.
But the thing for me about Murrayfield is the reason why, when the debate was between Murrayfield and Hampden, it was between a rock and a hard place, because Murrayfield, Edinburgh's not a great city for getting to.
No, it's a complete bottleneck.
Because half of Edinburgh,
anybody that travels into Edinburgh regularly will realise how difficult it is, A, to get in by driving, and B, to get out by driving.
Yeah.
It is very difficult, and even by public transport, anybody that's been to a Six Nations game, well, put it this way, the last time I went through to see Scotland against Ireland at Murrayfield, I had to travel in the luggage rack of the train.
Well, did somebody lift? I know which luggage rack you're talking about, but I have actually visions of somebody lifting you up into the bit that's up atop. I know you're talking about the luggage rack at the end.
It was quite roomy. It was great. it was also the train conductor went round the train giving people stickers, and they had to write what destination they were going to in case they fell asleep.
Half of Edinburgh.
So the conductor could wake them up and get them off.
Half of Edinburgh is blocked off by the Forth.
Mm.
So your bottleneck thing is, if you're approaching by a road, you get funneled into the one bit. So you reach the outskirts of Edinburgh in roughly an hour, that you think, from Glasgow. But then it's the getting from that point in. And okay, so most people come to Glasgow in the M8, but you've got the M9. You can go further round to then get the M74. But you can also then take lots of other roads. All the Edinburgh roads all then funnel in. And I know that the roads coming into Glasgow for grounds eventually funnel in.
Yeah.
But they don't funnel in the minute you hit the outskirts of Glasgow. You're all then getting to the one point, which is Edinburgh. And then at least there's two separate main train stations. You can come into Queen Street and you can... Not this weekend, obviously. You can come into Queen Street and you can come into Central. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Edinburgh... Yes, the two main stations, but they're on the same bloody line. It's just one and then the other. He marked it Waverley.
Uh-huh. I do have concerns about segregation and, you know, security and what have you. What got me about the whole League Cup semi-final debacle was that, again, it started off as a rock and a hard place. And then it quickly descended into farce. That whole idea of playing both games at Hampden with a, I think it was a 7-hour time difference, was laughable, to say the least. Then it quickly emerges that contractually they were tied into that sort of arrangement. So again, you have to question, the abilities of people who have negotiated that sort of thing in the past. And even just from a common sense point, you know, surely, you know, security concerns would negate this sort of contractual arrangement. So you'd have to play one at an alternative venue. But yeah, the big thing that struck me was none of these four teams like each other. You know, and that threw in an extra spanner into the works. None of these teams and their supporters actually get on very well with each other. They don't have much time. So, you know, it wouldn't be like, you know, folk, you know, I remember going up to the Scottish Cup final against Hibs, and while I wouldn't say, you know, I was joining hands with anybody or anything like that, there was a level of banter and comfortability that I had with Hibs fans and that I wouldn't have had with maybe other groups of supporters. You're not going to get that for at least two League Cup semis. That's for damn sure, you know. So yeah, I do have concerns about that sort of aspect, if you want to put it like that.
So on to, just conscious of how long we've been rambling on, going all sorts of subjects.
You're going to have fun editing this, aren't you?
I never edit. Edit, you mistake me for somebody else.
Are you going to have a Blu-ray version? You know,
director's cut.
Jar Jar Binks appearing out of nowhere.
I don't know if I'll get this out in time for Thursday night's game tomorrow, which, as we're recording this, tomorrow night's game.
But like a fine wine, Harry. Let it just stay. Let it relax.
In case I do. So there's a guy, in terms of being in the know, Tim, I certainly am not that much in the know because I never get any of these texts about what the team's going to be in advance. It seemed to people get. But a guy on Monday, what day is today? Today's Wednesday. A guy on Monday tweeted a team which somebody else has now tweeted tonight as being the team that he expects.
Yeah.
And the team is Gordon, Gamboa, Boyata, Simonovic, Tierney.
Is this for Thursday night?
This is for Thursday night. Kouassi, McGregor, and Cham. Morgan, Edward, Christie.
Oh, that's very avant-garde, isn't it?
When somebody showed me the first guy's tweet, I said, "No, they're not gonna have the team already decided on Monday, and they're not going to play Simonovic when they can play Benkovic." Then he said, "Yeah, but don't forget Boyata's injured. We've got a game Thursday and a game Sunday, and Boyata's injured." Is Boyata suspended for Sunday, so Simonovic needs game time.
Right.
And we can't expect everybody to play both Thursday night and Sunday. So he's going to need to rest some, right? Okay.
Okay.
So we'll probably... based on our earlier discussion about Celtic losing away from home in Europe, we're probably going to lose anyway. So
what's the point?
Would you not be better... playing, I've subsequently heard that Benkovic might also have a niggle, and that's the other reason why he might not be playing. So what do you think of that team? Apart from avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
Oh, and Brown's injured.
How middle class am I? I don't have a huge problem with that, to be perfectly honest. I think Gamboa's earned a shot, hasn't he? You know, he hasn't really let us down this season, to be perfectly honest, every time he's played. And I totally get the point about Simonovic needing game time as well. What you're saying about Benkovic, of course, Boyata's suspended for Sunday. So I suppose he's a shoo-in for Thursday as well. I wonder how some players are playing and training as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are they earning their shot there? Quite possibly, because I think that's one of Brendan Rodgers' big things, isn't it? Is that you play hard and you train hard, don't you? You know, and people that slip under that standard obviously get dropped. So I wonder if Kouassi is and Morgan have earned their shot there as well. I don't have a huge problem. I think Lustig, we could keep him for Sunday, couldn't we? You know, I think Gumbo is an able substitute in that respect. I think Morgan, I really like Morgan. I went to see St Mirren a couple of times last season, and every time he played, he really impressed me. And the couple of times he has made an appearance, again, I don't think he's disgraced himself. I think he's the one thing that impresses me about Morgan is he's actually quite brave on the ball,
mm-hmm.
and he shows for the ball. Whereas early in the season, there was quite a lot of people hiding. You know, so yeah, I don't have a huge problem with that, to be perfectly honest.
So, as I say, this may end up, I'll leave it in, do you know what, because I can't be asked editing. This may not go out before Thursday, so what's your prediction for the score for Thursday?
Oh God.
So people could be listening to this knowing that we've already won 4-0 away. So
I think it'll be 4-0 away, obviously, Harry. I think we're just going to storm it. I don't know. I think, Jesus, Leipzig are a good team now, aren't they? You know, they're not doing so badly in the Bundesliga, if I'm not mistaken, either. As he quickly brings up BBC Sport on his iPhone. I would actually be content with any sort of result, and preferably a shutout in defence as well. Although, you know, people accuse me of drinking now as well, won't they? You know, with that sort of prediction.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm actually, I'll be honest with you, I'm more concerned about getting through to the League Cup final.
So then on to Sunday. What's your prediction for Sunday?
I think we'll beat them. I think Hearts are, I think it's about time we took these boys down the size a wee bit. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially after the last few fixtures we played in Edinburgh against them. The last game at Tynecastle, we never showed up. It was almost embarrassing, quite frankly. I think we owe these boys a performance, you know. So I think we'll turn up. I think it will be a hard game. They are a very physical team, and they will get away with a physical approach. But I think this time we'll meet it, and I'm fairly confident that we will progress.
Okay, well, with that, Sean, non-writer of the 90s and 21st century books, I'll say thanks very much.
Not a problem, Harry. Pleasure.
Oh, and the Football Collective. I need to stick that.
Oh, and the Football Collective. Again, check out the website, check out the Twitter account as well, even just to keep yourself up to date with new articles and research that's being published as well.
Okay, with that, I'll say thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
Now, in that podcast, Sean makes reference to the need to edit that, and probably halfway through that ramble, when you're thinking, what the hell are they talking about? You maybe are sitting thinking, yeah, you bloody should have edited, but you know what? Two things. One, Wednesday night, I want to get this out before the game, so I can't be bothered editing it. Number two, getting back to the sort of chat that Sean and I were having, when Eddie started the podcast and then when I continued it, for those of you who've not listened for the 13 seasons that we've been going, the idea behind it was just, it's some Celtic fans recording the rambling chats that we have that dip in and out of football and sometimes have nothing to do with it. So that is what it is.
wanted us to ramble on as we did, or if not, well, you know, people listen or they don't listen, it's up to you. Anyway, enough of me. Hope you enjoyed that. I did enjoy the chat with Sean, and get on about the Football Collective to find out more about that. This is me, Harry Brady, saying I hope you enjoyed that. There definitely will be another podcast along soon, because St Anthony's recording one just now, particularly if you're a governorite like him, you'll really like his podcast. It's me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.